All right, so I hope this is on. I thank everyone for showing up on this fine Friday morning. I was a little afraid I was going to be like one of those senators on C-SPAN, you know, just talking to an empty audience. But I'm going to talk about the whim, giving mostly the theoretical side of things, mention observations, but really Ken is going to talk in detail about a lot of the observationals that have happened in the last few years. Very exciting stuff. But I'm going to give more of a broad overview, some of which you will probably undoubtedly be pretty familiar with. So I'll try to go through that stuff pretty quickly. So just to set the stage, the WHIM has been called the missing baryons. I'll talk a little bit about what exactly that means. And then talk about the way, different ways that people have proposed and are actually starting to detect the warm-hot intergalactic medium, and in particular what the simulations and theory tells us about what sort of things should be detectable and what might be the best way to go about detecting this gas. Talk about correlations with galaxies, and then finish up with some issues that have just started to become quite interesting regarding galactic winds, which we've heard a lot about at this conference, and talk about some simulation issues. So, missing baryons, right? So this is probably a familiar story to a lot of you. We have a concordance in omega B from a variety of different measurements. Is there like a pointer around here? Is this, okay, there we go. So we have that the baryon density in the universe is around, you know, 4 or 5% critical density. And we have this list of things, all of which give incredibly precise answers and don't agree with each other at any sigma level, but that's okay because they all sort of give the same answer for government work of around these values. And then you try to go at low redshift, and a number of people have done that. This is the classic paper by Fukugita, Hogan, and Peebles, where you just try to estimate the amount of baryons in various components that you see in the local universe, and you come up with a number that's fairly short. Now, this number doesn't seem too short, but you have to realize that this number is kind of made up a little bit. I mean, they just sort of extrapolated what they thought would be in groups, and it's a very large number. So that's where they're putting the missing baryons in essentially small groups that would be, you know, too soft to see in the X-rays. But the simulations tell a little bit of a different story. And in particular, the simulations, as you probably have heard by now, say that it lies in this conveniently undetectable regime where the gas is tracing the filamentary structures of large-scale structure that form naturally. This is a simulation by Chen and Ostreicher here, viewed here, and this is just a temperature color-coded, so you see the 10 to the 5 gas in the green filaments, and then the denser gas is a little bit hotter in the regions there. So this is the warm-hot intergalactic medium. This is a good picture. I'm sure you've seen it before. And the canonical definition, which was first forwarded by Chen and Ostreicher, is that it's intergalactic gas that lies, or cosmic gas, really, not even necessarily intergalactic, that lies between 10 to the 5 Kelvin and 10 to the 7 Kelvin. Now, that's pretty close. But there's a number of different other definitions that people sort of use interchangeably, and they're not exactly interchangeable, and we're getting to a point where it's important to make these sorts of distinctions. So there's one definition that's sort of the theorist definition of warm-hot intergalactic medium, and that is you're looking at unbound collisionally ionized gas. So that's gas that's not in groups, not in bound systems, is out there in the universe and has been shock-heated by the accretion process onto these large-scale structures. And if you look in detail at what temperature range that implies for redshift zero, it's not really a firm upper and lower cutoff, but in fact it does extend all the way down to 10 to the 4. Even you get some gas that's in this sort of physical state. And once you get above about 10 to the 6.5, most of the stuff in the universe is actually ends up in groups, if you look at it in the simulations. So the temperature range is a little bit different. And then there's a third definition, of course, that everyone sort of has latched onto, is the missing baryon definition, which is to say that we usually see intergalactic gas either in H1 absorption or X-ray emission, and if we can't see it in either of those things, then it's missing, and we'd like to find these missing baryons. So, and again, that doesn't, relating these three is a non-trivial task, and it's something that, I think the simulations have something good to try to, will try to say something interesting about in the near future. So let's, so just to introduce the cosmological phase diagram, which I don't know if that's, this has actually been shown in this meeting. This is a density temperature plot of the gas particles within a simulation. This particular simulation is one of Springel and Hernquist simulations, and which we've heard a lot about, so I don't want to belabor that point. But you see the various phases, this is at redshift zero, of these baryons. So this stuff down here, this is the point, the resolution is a bit misleading because there's actually a lot of baryons, a lot of points piled up right along this line. That line is the line that you get from the competition between adiabatic expansion of the universe and photoionization heating. And so radiative of cooling is irrelevant here. There's, the densities are too low. These are over densities, less than about 100 or so. And there's a lot of gas sitting at that regime. Those baryons are cool enough that most of them do a lot of H1 absorption. So that's sort of a component that gives rise to Lyman alpha forest. We've got that one. Here's the hot baryons, the stuff living in clusters above roughly 10 to the 7 Kelvin, or if you want to push this down, maybe more realistically 10 to the 6.5 Kelvin with current instruments. And this stuff, of course, we can see this in X-ray emission for the most part. That's not missing. Then this is the most familiar stuff, of course, the gas that's living in galaxies, which is, you know, molecular gas, cold, neutral hydrogen, so on and so forth. And that stuff, you know, this is some art, essentially, just from the two-phase representation in Gadget. But basically, this is cold, dense gas. And this is gas that's available to form stars on a fairly short time scale. And then, finally, we have this stuff in between, which is this warm-hot baryon, which covers a large range in both densities and temperatures. And one thing that you can do, then, is to ask the question, what is the mass fraction in each of these components as a function of cosmic time? So in this particular simulation, which is a little bit atypical because of the winds that are in there, but not terribly atypical, at least within a factor of 2 agrees with most other things. And what you see is this is color-coded here, so you see the diffuse phase over here. Virtually all the baryons before about a redshift of 4, certainly maybe even 3, are in this Lyman alpha forest phase, and that's why we can use the Lyman alpha forest to do things like measure omega B and measure the ionizing background, blah blah blah. So, and then you have the cluster phase, which only starts growing at late times. You see the cold baryon phase, which includes the stars. There's a lot of early star formation, and then after about redshift 2, the star formation slows dramatically. Okay, so simulations produce a lot of early stars. This is another talk, but it's an important thing to realize. And finally, there is the warm-hot intergalactic medium, which you see starts to grow along with the structures and eventually ends up as, in this simulation, between about 45% of the baryons are in this 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 7 phase. So that's a lot. And obviously, if we want to make a census of them, we'd like to be able to detect them in some way. So what are some of the physical properties that we're aiming for? Well, the warm-hot intergalactic medium, the temperature of it, essentially, there's a fairly simple physical process that's going on here, and that's that the gas is inflowing into filaments and shock heating. And so the size of those filaments, the typical size of those filaments, is going to be the nonlinear collapse scale at any given epoch. And so you can estimate what the temperature, the peak temperature of that gas should be, and it agrees quite well with simulation. So here's essentially a histogram of gas at the various temperatures, and what you see is that at early times it peaks sort of around 10 to the 6, but by the time you get to redshift 0, it's peaking at a few times 10 to the 6. So in fact, this is where canonically most of the gas lives at 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 7. Once you get above this value, you start seeing a significant drop in that because most of these gas baryons are then able to be in groups. So if you just use the 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 7 definition, then still less than about a third of this gas is in bound objects, and most of these are at this high temperature end. Now you can see here a phase diagram just isolating with a contour plot on the warm-hot gas. So I'm going here from about 10 to the 4.5 up to, well, whatever, hot gas. And you see the contours sort of start in the inner parts. So most of the typical densities of the typical overdensities of this warm hot gas lie between sort of 10 and 100. So this is stuff that's living sort of just on the outskirts or outside, you know, in filaments and on the outskirts of bound systems. And but there is a large scatter. There's a density broadly a density temperature relationship of that rho goes roughly as T, and that's in contrast with the Lyman Alpha Forest, where the slope is shallower, and because of that balance between adiabatic heating and photoionization, adiabatic cooling and photoionization heating. So how would we like to detect this? Well, it was realized fairly early on by a number of people that I think Chen and Oestreicher were the first to point this out, that oxygen 6 might be a very good transition to try to trace this warm hot gas. And the reason is, of course, that it has a collisional, first of all, it's a very strong line, it's a strong transition, and it has a collisional ionization maximum at around 300,000 Kelvin. And you see here ionization fractions as a function of temperature for the various oxygen species and also nitrogen and carbon. And here's oxygen 6, this dashed line. So you see that it peaks in a very narrow range of temperatures around 300,000 and just have it with just collisional ionization. You also notice that, of course, oxygen 7 is by far the dominant thing over most of the warm hot range. However, when you start to add photoionization, the picture changes quite a bit. And the reason is in particular because in these low density regions, this density, I don't know, you probably can't read it, but it's over density of tens, few tens, so typical of WIM. You see that photoionization can contribute quite a bit to the fraction of oxygen in the state of oxygen 6. So essentially, this is just photoionizing the very low density gas up to oxygen 6. And you see similar sorts of things for the other species, nitrogen and carbon, going up from carbon 4 to carbon 6. So the whole trick, of course, is that if you want to count baryons that are part of this collisionally ionized phase, you have to make sure that you're not double counting the stuff that's in the photoionized phase, which you would probably trace with the H1 as well. So Ken will talk more about this, but in fact, these oxygen 6 systems, there was a large survey by a number of people led by Todd they looked for these oxygen 6 systems, and they found quite a few of them. So the DNDZ at a given equivalent width limit is probably something like, you know, a little bit less than a half what you get for H1 lines. So they're quite ubiquitous. And so here's just an example of one of these oxygen 6. It's a doublet line, 1032, 1037. So this redshifted out to about 0.14 seen in an intervening system. And you see that thanks to the sparseness of the Lyman Alpha Forest, you can actually pick out these oxygen 6 systems at low redshift fairly straightforwardly. And when you do some very straightforward, very sort of broad numbers of how many baryons are living in these oxygen 6 systems that Todd found, and Todd and collaborators found, you find that it's significant. It's at least as much as you find in the amount of stars that are in the universe today. So just in these oxygen 6 systems, you're already tracing a pretty significant component of the baryons. And in fact, this broadly confirms the simulation idea that there's a lot of gas living at these hot phases. But now we can try to think about this in a little bit more detail, of course, with the simulations. We can try to investigate, you know, what exactly are these oxygen 6 systems, and can we understand them in more detail in terms of their physical conditions. So here's a nice picture by Tao Fang and Greg Bryan from some of their simulations, which shows the overdensity in a particular volume. This is 20 megaparsecs on a side. And you see that here's the oxygen 6 absorption in column density. And you see that these are getting up to something like 10 to the 15 in column density, which is very easily detectable. Even down to a few times 10 to the 13 is detectable. So you see that it follows the density structure quite well. And this is, you see several trends. One is that the higher column density systems tend to live in the hotter gas, if you look down here. So this is something like 10 to the 5. You know, you expect this sort of cyan gas to be where the collisional ionization stuff from oxygen 6 lives, and you can see that in these dense regions you end up with the collisionally ionized oxygen 6. So you can shoot lines of sight through it and get statistics, and Chu-Lei Chen had a nice paper where he did this for oxygen 6 and as well as various other X-ray species. And the bottom line is something like this. So here's the two data points from Todd Tripp. This is the number per unit redshift interval or something like that as a function of equivalent width. And of course, there's many fewer high equivalent width lines compared to low equivalent width lines. And if you make you take a simulation which gives you the density and temperature at every point and therefore gives you the ionization conditions, and all, you can also figure out how much is collisionally ionized, how much is photoionized, and figure out what the oxygen 6 fraction is directly from the simulation conditions. And that, of course, allows you to turn some kind of metallicity into what you would see for an oxygen 6 optical depth. And when you do that exercise, what you find is that for typical values of something like a tenth solar, you get about the right number of oxygen 6 absorbers. So this is solar metallicity. If the IGM that was doing oxygen 6 absorption had solar metallicity, we should expect to see this many. If it's tenth solar, you can try to do some number of different things. You can add a scatter to it. You can take the density over density relationship from what was predicted by Chen and Ostreicher in 99. That none of that seems to make that much of a difference, which also gives about 0.1 solar in the relevant regime. And you can compare it to this paper, and we all sort of get the same result. So it's kind of a generic thing. At the level that we can do the comparison now, or that we could do the comparison back then, something like a tenth solar produces the oxygen 6 absorption, reproduces that quite well. Now, we'd like to go in a little more detail and try to understand where this oxygen 6 absorption is coming from. So what I've done here is taken this gadget simulation and plotted some physical quantities or observable quantities versus physical quantities, assuming this particular metallicity relation, which is again taken from Chen and Ostreicher. And what you see, so what I'm doing here is plotting the oxygen 6 optical depth versus the temperature of the gas, and I'm going to color code the stuff that's above 10 to the 5, this canonical WIM gas, by red points. Okay, and what you see is, so you first see this very characteristic tail where due to essentially photoionization, you have this oxygen 6 absorption that's coming from photoionized gas that's quite cool. And then as you move towards higher optical depths, you can start to see fewer of these photoionized gas and by fraction, more of these hot systems. But of course, the hot systems occur at all optical depths, because of course you can, if you go a little bit too hot, you end up with, less oxygen 6. And so if you look at some other spaces, for instance, this is optical depth in oxygen 6 versus the baryon density at that given point, the hydrogen number density, and you see that in fact the hotter systems are somewhat separated, but not cleanly separated in this plot. And in particular, if you wanted to try to estimate what the physical condition, the temperature of the gas is, just if you have H1 information and oxygen 6 information, you find that turns out to be quite difficult. So here's the cooler photoionized absorbers, and then here's these collisionally, hotter collisionally ionized stuff. And except for the fact that the scatter is somewhat larger, it's very difficult to separate these two. So the one thing that you can take away from this is that once you get stronger oxygen 6 lines, you end up with a larger fraction of hot systems. So this is seen in these plots. So what I've done here is taken the number density above a given equivalent width limit. And so these are similar to the plot that I just showed a couple of slides ago, except now I'm going to break up these samples into cold, below 10 to the 5 and above 10 to the 5, actually above 10 to the 4.7, just for illustrative purposes. And what you see is that the hotter systems tend to be much less frequent in the small equivalent width regime, but once you get out to large equivalent widths, you end up predominantly having the hotter systems. However, it's not an extremely sharp transition, as you see here. It's still at 40 or 50 milliangstroms. You end up with a significant fraction of photoionized absorbers. You can look at it's the same story if you look at the calm density distribution. One of the interesting things is here's a criterion that basically separates stuff that's above the photoionization temperature versus on the photo or below the photoionization temperature. And so most of these oxygen 6 absorbers are actually coming from things that have been shock heated a little bit. So at all equivalent widths. It's just that if you want to make a 10 to the 5 criterion, then you end up with, in fact, even a thing that's even worse than this in terms of finding the hot stuff. Now, one would think that the B parameter would be a nice thing to sort of, you know, distinguish the two. Unfortunately, it doesn't end up that way, as the cold stuff and the hot stuff ends up, you know, fairly indistinguishable in terms of its B parameters. And this because, of course, there's a lot of other things going on besides thermal broadening. There's, you know, Hubble flow broadening. There's, you know, perhaps some turbulence caused by winds that flow, so on and so forth. The galaxy correlation turned out to be somewhat interesting. So the what I did here is to count pairs of galaxies and absorbers, galaxies identified in simulations, with, you know, less than about 2 H inverse megaparsecs, out to some particular velocity intervals, so redshift intervals. And what you see here's the H1 galaxy absorption for comparison, and what you see is that, in fact, you see correlations out to a few hundred kilometers per second, which is also what's seen by Williger and company and a number of other people at lower redshifts. So that's in pretty good agreement. Now, if you go to the oxygen 6, something interesting happens. At the lower column densities, just to give you a rough marker, 10 to the 14 corresponds to roughly about 100 milliangstroms. This is 30 and this is 10 milliangstroms. So as you're down at like 10 and 30 and 50 milliangstroms, most of these stuff is photoionized gas. It's tracing the same stuff as H1 and has very similar cross-correlation with galaxies. However, once you go into, you know, are really selecting out the hot collisionally ionized stuff that's living in these filaments, then your cross-correlation rises quite dramatically. So this is a prediction. I don't know if this is true. We're working on getting the data for this. Jason is doing imaging in the fields that Todd Tripp has. Todd has something like 50 oxygen 6 absorbers now, and we're hopefully going to be able to try to make these types of comparisons. That oxygen 6 is, of course, not the only game in town. It's certainly the best studied one. Oxygen 7, like I mentioned, is the strongest transition. So here's temperature. This is 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 5. And oxygen 7 is sort of the strongest transition right where the dominant component of the WIM gas is. Here's a list of a number of other far UV transitions. The only problem is a lot of them are sort of in the far UV such that if you want to observe them with current UV detectors, which require you to be at least 900 angstroms, you got to redshift it out to, you know, 0.3, 0.5, something like that, which, of course, limits the number of targets that you can do. Ken will talk more about the baryonic structure probe, which proposes to do things like this. The X-ray absorption is a tricky game. There's been some claims. They've been argued. The sort of two claims that I am pretty confident of are detected by a flaring Markarian 421, where he found two extragalactic or intervening systems. And here's an illustration by Chen et al., which shows that for, you know, so here's a 10th solar type metallicity, that XMM and Chandra are going to have a pretty tough time seeing too many of these things. Now, of course, when you have a flaring thing that brightens by a factor of 100, that helps you. But I think to really do this, do the X-ray stuff well, you're going to probably have to have another instrument or maybe use GRBs or something like that. You can also try to detect WIM in emission. This is not maybe surprising because the densities are quite low, but it's not totally impossible. It's of course biased towards high density since it's an n squared type thing, and as a result of being biased towards high density, it's also biased towards the higher temperatures, and also possibly the higher metallicity regions, which is of course any sort of bias when you deal with these metalline type things. And there has been some detections which have been proposed as warm-hot intergalactic medium type detections. Here's an example image from an MBE, from this missing baryon explorer, which is one of the proposed missions. And you see, these are all, you know, significant detections, all this stuff. So this is sort of warm-hot gas, but it's quite difficult to do. And in particular, the things that really stand out are, of course, essentially poor groups of galaxies, right? Because that's what lives in around the 10 to the 5, or 10 to the 6.5, you know, to 10 to the 7 regime. So the problem is that I think WIM emission, while it's in principle possible, it's one of these things that is not going to be a great job, great thing to get a census of these warm-hot baryons, because really what you're going to be end up seeing for the most part is just groups, and it'd be great for that, you know, poor groups, line emission from poor groups, but it's going to be tough to do this stuff in emission. And Steve Ferlinetta also has done some nice work on this, which I think comes to similar conclusions. So this just illustrates that if you have WIM emission, you can cross-correlate it with galaxies, and you see a different signature depending on the ion, which is essentially testing the density-temperature relation in this warm-hot regime. But you see the cross-correlations are significant out to, you know, something like, you know, half megaparsec, megaparsec. I mean, these are essentially group-type environments. You know, you don't see them much weighed out into the many megaparsecs. So there's been a lot of talk about wind. And one of the things that in fact was you know, the people realized quite early on is that, of course, if you want to inject a whole bunch of metals into the IGM, you have to inject a whole bunch of energy into the IGM, and therefore you might end up with a lot of gas that gets heated up to these temperatures, not through gravitational processes, but rather through just collisional processes from outflows or things like that. So here's an example of a simulation. This is, for those of you who are in the know, this is the D4 simulation from Fokker. But what I've done is I've done two runs. One, well, Fokker did the run with winds. I did a run without winds. Okay, so I turned off the winds and saw what the difference is. Now, what's plotted here is a temperature scale. So the black regions are 10 to the 4 and the or below, and the very lightest regions are around 10 to the 8. So the stuff that's warm hot gas that would be traced by, let's say, oxygen 6 emission is sort of this magenta stuff. And you see that the covering fraction ends up quite a bit higher than without the winds. So now, you know, this is just one wind model. It's a very somewhat ad hoc model. You could imagine doing different things, but this is just an illustration that, in fact, the winds can have a non-trivial impact on this warm-hot intergalactic medium at low redshift. One of the simple things you can do is to just ask the question, what is the baryon mass fraction in the warm-hot phase with and without winds? So here's this plot. So here's this D4 run here, and here's the D4 no wind run. It ends at redshift 1, unfortunately, but you can see the trend. And that is that in the wind case, you end up producing quite a bit of warm-hot gas at early times. Okay. This is when gravity doesn't really have a chance yet to build up significant structures, and a lot of the baryons that are in this 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 7 regime might be out there due to the presence of winds. These other runs just show, you know, illustrate resolution and box size issues. So, of course, one of the interesting things about this is that at redshift 2, there are now observations of a lot of oxygen 6 systems. Rob Simcoe has worked on this. I think Bob Carswell is involved as well. And what they find is that most of these oxygen 6 systems tend to be photoionized and not collisionally ionized. So there may be some constraints on the types of wind models that you can put in there if you require that a lot of these oxygen 6 absorbers are really just photoionized. Okay, so one last thing I wanted to mention. I mean, I've sort of, you know, berated the observers a little bit, say, oh, we need more data and better missions and so on and so forth, but in fact, we need better models as well. And in particular, three of the things that I think are extremely important to put in the models that are not in all the models or in some of the models. The first one is, of course, metalline cooling, and this is particularly important for emission. I mean, if you want to calculate the emission from an object and it's at a density and temperature that has been set by primordial cooling, and then you add metals and suddenly say, what's the emission? Well, you might get a completely wrong answer than if it had been in equilibrium with metalline cooling. So I think this is certainly a crucial thing to try to do for the emission studies, but it could also be important for the absorption line studies, particularly at higher densities. Non-equilibrium ionization effects. Most simulations these days, although RENUs are an exception, assume ionization equilibrium. And this is fine for hydrogen and helium, really, because the hydrogen and helium got ionized very early on. There's very low ionization fractions. So, you know, the fact that they don't end up out of equilibrium very much. It's not good if you want to look at something like oxygen 6, right? Because the oxygen 6 is maximized in a very narrow interval, and you could definitely imagine a lot of non-equilibrium effects happening because the recombination time is quite long compared to, or at least is comparable to, the age of the universe. So I think this is unfortunately quite hard to put in there, but it's something that I think needs to be addressed, particularly if you want to study a small set of transitions, and certainly oxygen is a good candidate for that. And then finally, there was an interesting paper by Naoki Yoshida and Steve and Lars Hernquist on the fact that if you have shocks into low density regions, what you end up with is you end up with a difference between the electron temperature and the ion temperature. And so here's an illustration of this. Here's all the gas. Here's the warm hot gas. And this panel is the gas where the electron temperature is less than half of the ion temperature. And you see that a lot of the warm hot gas ends up in this situation, particularly in the immediate regions around galaxies. Now, I don't quite understand the plasma physics well enough to know if this is. I mean, there's a lot of other. There's some other effects that can bring the electron temperature and the ion temperature back into equilibrium that weren't included here. So I think there's some debate about this, but this is certainly an important effect if this is really going to be a real thing. Okay, so that's my conclusions. Current simulations predict a sizable amount, as we well know. And unfortunately, the O6 absorbers that you find are a mixed bag. They're not necessarily the stuff that you would they tend to be shock heated at some level, but they're not necessarily part of the canonical WIM, even at fairly strong absorption strengths. And it's going to be somewhat difficult just from O6 and H1 data to really get an estimate of this. So I think that simulations are going to be vital to try to interpret these sorts of things as the data gets better and better, which it certainly has already done so. X-ray absorption in principle is great, in practice is really tough. Galaxy absorber correlations, I think, are one way to make a lot of progress. Emission is difficult, but I think something that is not impossible, and certainly the only caveat is it really just traces the hottest, densest gas. And I think that a lot more study is needed on the impact of winds and possibly preheating type things for the warm, hot gas. Thanks.
Amazing sensitivity is one that rides just slightly above 2 × 10⁶ degrees. At 3 × 10⁶ degrees, all those iron L lines start to appear.
Right.
Very strong.
Yeah.
So how secure are you in this temperature band? You don't get a tiny little bit higher.
Well, so it depends on what you want to look at. I mean, if you get a tiny little bit hotter, just you can do simple Precheck arguments and show that you know you're really going to start to produce a lot of gas in groups. So, is this really intergalactic gas that you're looking at or not? I'm not that secure to within a factor of 2, I would say, because it depends on a lot of other physical processes. I think the gravitational stuff is fairly secure and seems to be quite consistent among all models, but the other stuff like winds and stuff could definitely mess with that. Yes, that's right. That's right.
It's a somewhat related question. How sure are you actually talking about intergalactic gas? Because imagine that you can get a little bit of more of your gas emission, and all this IGM starts pulling in virtually small groups that cannot be actually dissolved. So how sure are you that you're actually dissolving the IGM and not an artifact of the fact that you don't have enough matter that to dissolve small groups in all this gas?
Well, I mean, so you can look at something, do something like look at, you know, how many groups you expect down at 10⁶ Kelvin and ask the question, how much gas is out there and can the gas actually sit in the group? I mean, you know, if the gas has already been heated in these filaments up to above 10⁶, it's not going to sit in these groups. So, you know, I mean, the simple way to do it is to just do a lot of resolution convergence studies, which we did, and showed that it is pretty robust. If you use the same numerical technique and just mess with the resolution, it has almost no effect. In fact, I had a plot there.
I just want to follow up that because I'm puzzled. If you're doing a simulation of galaxy formation at the same time as you're doing a simulation of the IGM,
right. Then
galaxies like the Milky Way hold on to million degree gas. They have a galactic halo and a galactic fountain, and that gas is radiatively cooling through these temperatures, so it will both emit and absorb. In fact, that's how we first discovered oxygen 6 absorption in the universe. So why are we not seeing the combined effect of lots of galaxies and galactic halos and interstellar media?
It's just a small fraction of what's there.
Because the total number of baryons in the galaxies is small, is that all there is?
That's basically
okay.
Regarding the strong correlation between galaxies and the WIM gas, the O6 in particular, that's a no feedback simulation, right?
That is a feedback simulation.
That is a feedback. So, So is there any signature of the feedback in that strong correlation?
I haven't looked at that in detail. It's, you know, feedback, you can look from the picture and see that the feedback doesn't mess up the correlation that much. It might broaden it a little bit just because of the fact that the winds tend to puff out the filaments a little bit. But the dominant signature is still going to come from the overdensity few tens gas that is not that affected by these winds. So I don't think that there's going to be a huge effect on the winds.
So
I haven't checked.
So that strong correlation with galaxies is simply the fact that it's residing in denser gas. The shocks are stronger.
That's right. You're getting a new different population of oxygen 6 absorbers, and you need to be in these dense filaments to get that shock heating, to get these strong absorbers.
Okay. Apart from simulation, do we have any observational hint of what the metallicity could be, at least in the cases where we can see both oxygen 6 or even and oxygen 6? Because that would be important, I think, to pin down.
Yeah, that's right. I think Jason mentioned some metallicity observations the other day, and so metallicity has clearly increased. Well, seems to have increased since redshift 3 or so, and it's sort of consistent with about 0.1 solar. At least, they were finding, I guess it was about -1.5. But then you have to worry about type 2 or alpha process enhancements. So the metallicities I was quoting were O over H. So that's, it would be great to get an independent handle on that so we could put that in. But I think at this point, we're sort of left with trying to put in what we have.
You mentioned at a higher redshift, oxygen 6 seems to be more photoionized.
Yeah.
Actually, the situation is a bit more complicated. Simcoe et al. Found that in the high H1 systems, the oxygen 6 is probably in a separate phase since it's displaced from the H1 and it's broader.
That's right.
Bob Carsell and I found, we looked at the low H1 systems, and Simcoe later did the same thing, and found that those are narrow and coincident in H1. So it seems, again, as you say here, as you find in simulations, that if you're closer to a galaxy, there's more collisionally ionized hot O6.
Right.
If you're further away, it's more photoionized, and that's true at higher redshift observationally.
Yeah. So I mean, that's to follow up on that. I mean, that's an interesting constraint. If this winds were very important, you might expect to see collisionally ionized gas far away from galaxies where these winds have deposited energy. So that's what I'm saying. It could be an important constraint on the wind models.
I just realized in thinking again about the relative importance of gas local to galaxies and local groups. Relative to the IGM on a larger scale. If you consider the metallicity-weighted mass fraction of baryons, I don't think your statement is correct anymore, that it's a small effect because most of the baryons are in the IGM, not local, not associated with galaxies. I mean, clearly, I gained at least an order of magnitude from your average over the whole IGM, and if some of that is weighted by what's in galaxies already, the non-galactic IGM has even lower metallicity.
Right. But the problem is, when you do absorption line stuff, you're essentially cross-section weighted, right? I mean, that's, you have random lines of sight.
Yeah.
So
that includes
which
metallicity.
Sometimes includes metallicity, and but it's very rare to pass close to galaxies where we see a significant effect. But again, we don't know how the galaxies are spitting out their metal, so this is all an open question.
this is responding to Paul's thing. You can see in the plot that he showed from our Chenodal paper, when we had the metallicity just be constant at 0.1 solar, or we had it depend with density like you're saying that it really should, the predicted number of oxygen 6 absorbers doesn't really change very much at all. You can see those if you can find the plot.
Yeah.
So you know that it just can't be that important. I mean, but you have to pick out the right lines there. So you look at the solid line.
But I mean, that would show up on this plot.
That would show up on the plot.
Well, no, you don't have a person density here, you're just counting lines. So you're leaving the number of lines fixed, but the distribution of how many of them are in higher density,
well,
shifting to higher density.
Well, it could be either one, we'll be checking.
Yeah.
Okay, one last question.
Just a comment, actually, and actually something I can talk about in my talk as well, if you like. The general issue of metallicity is still pretty wide open. And in fact, even, I mean, there are still factors of several floating around even in things like DNDZ. The DNDZ used here, I think, is 50, right? And that was based on Todd's original paper. And since then, the numbers come down to about 15. So, you know, there are these factors that float around. Well, it's a selection effect, right? I mean, you have to be careful in interpreting data from just one sight line. And they did the best they could with what they have at the time, but as time goes on, you get better estimates of that, and that may help to pin the metallicity down as well.
That's right.
Okay, let's see where we are.